Hi, my name is Karen Thorson, and I am a producer on The Wire, and this is an episode from our fourth season of the series. And I'm with an actor and an editor from the episode.
Young and y'all in them.
Hi, I'm Kate Sanford. I'm the editor of this episode and also been a series editor on the show since season one.
And I'm Jim True Frost. I play Prez since the beginning of the show. Originally Detective Prez Belusky, and as you've seen this season, I'm Mr. Presbo, a teacher at Edward Tillman.
Edward Tillman Middle.
Bye-bye. Showtime.
Right now we're looking at Omar.
Nigga, turn.
Jamie Hector, who plays Marlo.
One day soon, I'm walking out with a rose here.
Where you been going to school?
The director of this episode is Jim McKay, who I really enjoyed working with. And there was a lot of footage shot for this particular sequence. And we wanted to cut it so that, as you saw, we stay in close pretty much the whole time and then reveal at the end of the game the wide shot and see where everybody is. But we really tried to keep it kind of intimate and a little bit suspenseful because, you know, Marlo can be such a menacing character. He wanted to really have a little suspense about how he was going to react to getting beat at the card game.
Yeah, and he does get beat. It's one of his first lessons, if you want to groove on a theme of education and learning. He's slowly learning a couple of things. It doesn't mean that he accepts the outcome, because he's not very adaptable to change or to losing. And he's still a kid. That's the other thing about these drug guys, is that the youth has passed them by and they still have a lot of kid in them, even though they've got incredible responsibilities and life or death issues that they face every day.
You think I dream of coming to work up?
So that's what the lollipop sort of tells me.
Tell all my friends what a good job I got. I'm working to support a family, man. Pretend I ain't talking to you.
And here's someone who challenges Marlo and actually tries to give him a little bit of advice and wisdom about what it is to be a responsible man in this world.
I don't. I'm here. Look, I told you I wasn't stepping two. I ain't disrespecting you, son.
You want it to be one way.
What?
This was a great scene to edit also, and Jim and I worked a lot on this performance in trying to make sure that the security guard was expressing himself, but that he wasn't stepping over the line. And as the episode goes on, you'll see what happens to this guy who does challenge Marlo's authority.
When you say he's not stepping over the line, you mean so that the scene would be unbelievable if it looks like, if you use a piece of the acting performance where the guy's really blowing it out, then the viewer might say, hey, why doesn't Marlo just respond?
Exactly.
It's really interesting to hear you use the word, you worked on the performance. You say you and Jim worked on the performance.
Right.
And it's one of the lessons we actors learn over and over again, is that what the final result shows is that the acting is mediated by so many elements, you know, the camera work and the editing, and that no matter what choices you think you're making as an actor, as the scene's going on or proceeding, or as you go take after take trying different things, there may be a whole other performance in quotes that's gonna make it to the screen.
Right. I mean, I don't mean to take anything away from the authenticity or the specificity of the performance, because we have so much respect for the actors on this show. But we do get in sometimes and shape it in terms of pace and in terms of the nuance of things. Yeah.
Being with the education theme and a focus on kids, the theme song is performed by a young kids choral group called Domage, and I'm sure somebody else has mentioned that, but sort of a new departure, and was fun music to work with in putting this scenario together that we call the main titles.
So my character gets the quote at the top of the show, and it's a great scene. It come right after that last clip that's at the end of the opening credits each week, which is the kids entering the schoolroom. Here's some of the kids who are my students in my math class in one of their other places of learning.
And they're recapping the slashing from the previous show.
Just saying. That's all you ever do. Just say. This shit was fucked up.
This is another area where we work a lot on performance, not necessarily different performances, but just on keeping the pace really snappy. And we want to, something we started in episode one, which I also cut, David really wanted these kids to almost just be interrupting each other the way normal teenagers do.
Boy, you cat-eating motherfuckers? Who want him some boy, you cats?
I've heard that's how she live.
Nigga, you been boy.
Letitia live up in one of them group homes off Edmonds. Places.
They're still kids. They still have fear and respect. Poor Randy's obsessed about group homes and having to return to one. Naaman's a little more flip and fun-loving.
Oh, if the boy not coming, you might as well let me and Michael go on the ring.
Hey, none of y'all seen Spotty today. How in the hell he gonna fight next week if he don't show up to train? I tell you what, till the boy shows up for his lesson, you can lace him up and step on the mat one time. No. Not him. Me.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to show you as gently as I can how much you don't know, all right?
Yeah, nigga, that's your ass. You got to get your
this
ass.
Scene actually was shot in two parts, so the part we just saw is kind of scripted as one scene, and then this section here where the deacon walks in and talks to Cuddy was shot as a separate scene a little bit later. And a lot of what we do is additional recording so that you can hear the voices of the kids going on in the background. All of this was recorded, supervised by Karen, and added later, which we do a lot.
Got some custodial work, you might call it. Union wage.
Custodial.
See Miss Donnelly tomorrow. She can explain it better.
Cuddy's adjusting to his new environment. He's a teacher of a different kind, like Jim is a teacher in the school.
Good church man is always.
But he's also learning how to integrate back into a life of a citizen, of earning money and not relying on the drug trade to propel him.
Who's winning?
No one wins. Once I just loses more slowly.
Why don't we get out of the house? Take a walk.
How did you like your second wife, Jim?
You may have heard in other commentaries, Karen's question refers to the actress here who is not the actress who played my wife in the first appearance of Prez's wife, who's Valchek's daughter, through an accident of actor availability, I presume.
I think so.
Yeah, that actress was just seen sort of in a group scene and didn't have any dialogue, so it's not something a lot of viewers probably noticed.
But that's unique. I think that's the one and only instance where we haven't been able to carry through relationships that have been established.
Which is astonishing, given the scope of the show and then the size of the cast. It does happen. It's surprising it doesn't happen more.
Yeah, that's just quick like that.
So here's the Rook coming to her new environment, and she's going to learn the ropes.
My humble abode, the board. And over here, this is your desk.
The easy way and the hard way.
It's clean.
You'll fix that. A clean desk is a sign of a sick mind.
Homicide. Damn.
I don't know where your chair went. Make that your first case. And put that down, will you? You live here now. Ooh, look. Actual police work.
Any of these?
Either one. Right there. Just put it to Fruit's head. And the next thing, Fruit on the ground flopping and his girl all screaming. And this pink shit coming out the side of his head.
The monk. Working weekends.
The man's dedicated. I'm gonna partner you with Crutchfield to get started. You won't catch anything as a primary for the first few months.
Crutchfield's a character that's first started out as an ADR line of Crutchfield, get the phone, and eventually he evolved into a real person that we cast and had real lines. So a little bit of a interesting origin of a character.
Lester.
Bill Delaney's character, Landsman, also has an interesting origin, and these scenes in Homicide always remind me of David's book, Homicide, which documented his work over the course of a year with the Homicide Department in Baltimore. And Landsman's dialogue especially always reminds me of the vivid scenes and dialogue that David records in that book.
Get on top of that shit before you catch a case.
Chair or no chair.
Isn't Landsman himself on the show?
Jay Landsman is in the show as Lieutenant Mello.
You see him at roll call sometimes.
Yeah.
Addressing the officers.
The hell is a methane probe?
See, here comes the beginning of the fraternal hazing for Greg's
yes, hello?
Being the lower guy on the rung.
Speak with Mr.
And it's
protocols.
The simplest and most base
Lyon.
Kind of humor, but it's a very funny scene. The prank call.
She's getting schooled.
This is Detective Greg.
And there was also a choice made back when she was getting the message out of the box. There were other performances where you could see Landsman and Freeman kind of smirking to each other. And we felt like that might give it away too much and went with a straightforward. So hopefully by the time you get to the end of the scene, you've also been fooled.
Hey, Jim, you were in the police force, your character. What is a methane probe?
By the way, that shot that
I was
just
spared the initiation.
I was going to say that shot that just went by, that establishing shot of the rim shop. I think we stole that from another season.
This is a great location because it just photographs so well. It's stunning and sexy and gives a DP a lot of opportunity to be not slick but just kind of fancy and pretty, where we're usually in a very gritty this is the way it is kind of scenario.
Yeah, I know you see it, you see the big picture. Probably what niggas say, they always see the narrow view.
It's nice.
What? Oh, you like that?
But we still need to discuss the methane probe, and we'll find another moment to do that.
Sentimental values, just a thing.
But here Andre's trying to school Marlowe again, but it's not going to meet with acceptance of perhaps a very good logic or a very good lesson.
You don't have to.
I'll find out for you.
And this is also the beginning of passing of the ring.
Yes.
Fingers swelled over the years.
Need some help?
Yeah, man. You need help?
Nah, I got it. I got it.
Maybe use some spit.
I don't want the man spit.
Nah, I got it now.
Omar ain't no terrorist.
Benga's portrayal of Chris always blows my mind because he seems sometimes like you're not sure if he's going to give you a massage or blow your head off. he's a very sweet and sensitive person, and when you meet him in person, and he doesn't try to hide that too much as an actor with this character. He sort of lets that complexity be part of the character. You know, he doesn't work real hard trying to make him a heavy or a hard ass.
Money too. Here's that beauty
how much
shot.
Need this time out?
100 and a half for the Duke.
100 and a half.
I'll take that chicken nose full one day soon. Take super stick too.
That's a sore get loser home. Speaking.
Else, maybe I'll get bored. See you to take them.
And my point, Colonel Forrest, is that your man Norris, he's fucking the dog on this way I hear it.
Sir, this is a top priority case. And Norris knows there's a possibility of a murder.
Richard DeAngelis in this scene unfortunately died not longer after we finished filming in December of that year. So this was his last performance on The Wire this episode.
Yeah, he has three scenes in this one. This is the first of three.
Work it around the clock, work it till it falls. And I understand we just pumped some fresh blood into Homicide. Female. Took one in the line a few years back.
She never worked Homicide.
That was real humbling for us in the cast. You know, he's such an interesting and kind person who has such a great history in the profession, and to see him come in when he was really on his last legs, but give it everything he had. Person in his position would have been probably very happy to stay at home and stay comfortable. And he worked so hard to do these scenes that were pretty simple physically, not a lot of action, but he wasn't well at all. And it was a real testament to his dedication, I think.
He's a nice guy.
Look, think on it like this. School is work. They're the same thing right now. So you skipping out on school is like not showing up for work. And I done heard, made up, and tested every excuse invented.
I love that. Bubbles has some lines that I want to repeat and remember forever, and that's one of them. I done made up, heard, tried, and tested every excuse ever made, something like that.
The way to start out a school year, particularly after a 3-year hiatus. We haven't seen you since you enrolled. Is there a reason you haven't joined us?
Look, I know you're reaching out for Sherrod. I want to apologize.
There's also another, what's also developing here is a fostering, a foster parenting thing, if you will. Bubbles is trying to nurture and take Sherrod on, and there's some parallels and other themes going on. Your character, for example, Jim, has that going on.
Yeah, I think it happens. You know, I talked a lot to Ed Burns about it, who had so much to do with the school storylines, with his drawing from his background, teaching for seven years, I think, after he left the police force. And also drawing from my own experience and what I heard from my wife being a teacher. There's so much need in the schools and so many needy kids in a school like this that anyone who's in a position of authority sort of has to walk that line of caretaker and mother and father and disciplinarian and teacher all at once.
You know, if this gets out, who do you think it's going to land on?
And it's great. I think you identified it really well, that Bubbles is a parent there and the principal's a parent, and I become a parent when he enters my classroom for about 6 seconds before he runs off again.
There's also an opportunity for us as the audience to be schooled about the bureaucracy of the school system, and that scene that just passed is another place where we learn about social promotion, which is a really sad and interesting fact. And then there are a couple other facts we're going to see coming up.
Mr. Presbyluski, this is Sherrod. He's all yours.
What were you thinking here, Jim?
Well, the scene is so well written, you know. It's set up in the earlier scene with me and my wife where I'm trying to think of a way to talk to the kids about this event that happened earlier where one student slashed another student. It was a big upsetting incident, and I feel like, well, I better, you know, help them process it, help them talk about it. I think what's clear is, or what I tried to show is that Prez is struggling to process it himself. He does his best to try to show them he's in control, give them an opportunity to talk about it, but he's so off balance that he can't approach them. As you can see, they're already moving on and joking.
They're kind of driving the scene in a way.
Yeah.
With their agenda.
Yeah, the first, as Ed said, it's like the whole first year of a teacher's life in a tough school like this. The kids are in charge. It just takes a really long time to exert control or take leadership of a classroom because there's just so much energy, so much confusion.
It's about working with the community.
The community? Y'all ain't been up in my community in a long time except the well on people.
Yo, Mr. P, you ever been shot? I mean, like, bang!
Name it. That's enough.
I think Jim McKay's aesthetic, the director's aesthetic, comes from a very realistic documentary kind of feeling background, and he shot a lot of footage of just the kids reacting and doing all kinds of things, and we open the scene with kids just sort of being kids and doing all their stuff, mm-hmm. and really tried to work a lot of those just tiny moments into the dialogue, and that's why a lot of it plays actually off of you.
Yeah, right. No, I saw that a lot in the directors who came into the classroom. Their eyes kind of lit up. You know, it was one of those places where the routine of shooting an episode and moving from location to location was kind of interrupted in a funny way because suddenly there's 25 12-year-olds in one room, which is, it presents a lot of challenges and a lot of opportunities, and it kept them on their toes, and it also was a lot of fun, I think, to shoot.
Yeah, and you, as you can see, the classroom's never really quiet. It's a busy place. There's a lot of chatter, and part of it is, as Jim was saying, there's a difficulty in resting authority. But even if you get the children focused, there's still a constant buzz going on all the time in the classroom.
We moved this scene up, actually. Chris and Snoop leave their surveillance on the security guard. We cut right to this. Originally, Randy, which is a scene after this, was before it. And sometimes we just shift things around slightly so that you can just track one story for a little while and then go back to the other one.
I love that character, Donut, who loves to boost cars. He loves to drive cars, and he's about, I don't know, 12 years old.
And about 4 foot two. Yeah.
He ain't no regular, he's just working off a debt.
Was he actually driving?
Why? Why you care?
Mind you, why? We had stunt drivers. I don't know how all these things are executed, but they're done within all the proper safety confines. So Bodie's just made a transition from Barksdale to Stanfield purely due to muscle. He had no choice. And Snoop and Chris basically said, you know, you're taking our package.
And so now we're back to Randy and the school story. And then also moving the scene around helped us track a little bit the Snoop and Chris and Bodie story, and then also gave Randy a little more time to get to lunch after escaping from math class.
Time stand still at Tillman Middle, and that would be a catastrophe.
I just forgot and wore my old shirt today.
Mm-hmm. Well, if this isn't your lunch, then where's your hall pass? Why not just write it in crayon? Come on.
Deacon says you're a good man.
Good enough to swing a mop, I guess.
Mop? More like a vacuum cleaner.
What?
I get a few fellows like you to help me out every September. You go out on the street, you find these kids, you drag them in.
Tootsie Duval, who plays the principal here, not principal, but what is she, a school administrator, came from our loop group. And she still does a lot of looping with us in the capacity of background looping.
You cross them off the list. Each kid, one time, clear the list. Come October, you start on the list again. Job's yours if you want. It pays 12 an hour. Excuse me, hon. Sit.
She was great as this character. She did a phenomenal job.
I loved working with her in this school scene. She really was great and brought a lot of authenticity to the scene. I, you know, have this attenuated connection with my wife having been a teacher, but Tootsie's been in Baltimore a long time and has been a teacher herself. Week and I got walls covered with tags. These schoolroom scenes were something she really had a lot of personal experience in and knowledge about, and she was a lot of fun to work with too. And I think she goes back to the corner. I think she appears
that may be
in a role as a Thompson, at a crab shack or something like that.
Wagstaff's foster mom.
What you want to call Miss Anna for?
Because you're skipping class, running the halls, maybe worse. She's got a right to know.
There's a lot going on in this scene because Randy is being pressured to snitch, and meanwhile, we wanted to work hard to keep Cuddy alive over there by the counter, keep him actively listening, but also keep the conversation focused on the two of them. So we go check in with Cuddy a couple times, listening and giving Randy the eye. Are you going to snitch? Don't snitch. Burrell wants this case
stalled until everybody votes. Well, yeah, and it opens up a whole other theme that's very, very closely examined in The Wire, and that is the role of the informant, snitching, who really benefits, who really loses.
And giving it to a rook so as not to make timely progress on.
And a kid like Randy, who just sort of likes to get away with as much as he can on a smile, you know, ends up into some bad situations. And his greatest fear is his home life. It's Miss Anna. He's got a foster mother. He just doesn't want to end up back in a group home. So that's the only thing that really can pull him back is the threat of telling on him and telling his foster mom. Because the consequences in his mind are really severe. And this is the weird, unusual beginning of the project. They get a grant to do basically a study on what it would be to
separate the stoop kids from the corner kids.
It's exactly what it is.
The way they describe the experiment. Move into the classroom and remove the kids that are causing the most disruption and put them in their own classroom, and that way both groups will fare better. That's the intention.
Those that want to learn won't be disrupted, and those that want to disrupt can be better disciplined or better instructed to their needs.
And as that scene we just watched shows, that the ongoing struggle is not just how to deal with the kids in those two classrooms, but how to deal with a bureaucracy that's so slow to accept ideas of change, even when they're really promising ideas.
Back in the scene, we wanted to make sure to show a couple of kids who were really affected by the disruptive nature of Naaman acting out and falling on the floor. And not only did Sherrod leave because things were so out of control, but there were a couple of girls who specifically wanted shots of them turning away and trying to ignore the chaos that's going on.
Pumping a radio car like a young sprite. I'm a little bit proud to know you, Officer McNulty.
Just a little bit?
Well, it ain't like there aren't better things you could be doing.
Like what?
See, I told you, Lester, the worm has turned for my boy.
So I heard they torpedoed your wiretap.
Yeah, they sent us a new lieutenant, Marimo, from E&T.
Marimo, the great character name.
Lester and Kima already bailed to homicide, and now Sitton is looking to jump at the first good opening.
Some major crimes is dead, huh?
Yeah. Lester killed it good.
This scene was actually shot before everything else in the episode due to Dominic West's schedule.
13 years.
4 months.
4 months. You guys call for backup or what?
Yeah. We got arrest papers on a murder.
The one Curtis Anderson, a.k.a. Lex, he's been on the wing for a couple of weeks, so I don't expect him at his mama's, but you never know.
What's the address?
643 Harlem. How about you taking the door with me for old time's sake, Jim?
I'll take the back, gents.
Oh.
Back. Damn, Junior, the worm has turned for you. You know what they say about the man who volunteers to take the back? He buys. B&O Tavern. Tonight at 9, son.
I'll throw myself out after one.
Shit.
You don't believe me, ask Bunk.
Two.
Drinking's another common theme in The
Wire.
An endless resource of inspiration.
It's clear.
Yeah, basement too.
Clear.
I may be wrong, but this may be the first time we've seen McNulty this year. Is that true?
Clear.
Hmm.
9 tonight, McNulty. B&O Tavern.
Well, he's refraining from alcohol. He's now in the Western on foot patrol. He's no longer a detective. And we're kind of relearning that in that previous scene.
Is he coming home again?
Man.
And here's another example of the theme you were just talking about informing or not informing, and what advantage will it be to the mother of this boy who's missing?
Gives us a murder warrant. And that warrant says that we can come through your door as many times as necessary.
I don't know where my son is.
And that's probably true.
It's like them birds of yours. They go out and they fly around the city. They free to do as they do. End of the day, they come back here.
Not really sure completely what the birds represent to the writers, but I love the reference here. I love the fact that it's one of the slender human moments that we catch of Marlowe, where he clearly cares for the birds. Occasionally we get to see him smile, but this is really the most human we ever got to see him. And I know there have been other references with pigeons and coops, like Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. There was such a character. And certainly On the Waterfront. It's the side of his character that I think is very special.
What I got to give up to get that good dope?
Muscle.
In episode one, also the kids have some pigeons.
Mm-hmm. Boys right out of East Baltimore.
Fuck, I care about East Baltimore.
The point of the co-op is we stand together. We share.
This is a great scene. There was a little bit more dialogue than you see here, and just simply for time, sometimes we'll have to go in and weed out a scene just a little bit. There was a little more back and forth where Prop Joe was trying to convince Marlo, and they had a couple more lines back and forth between them, but we felt like this was enough to convey. He's extended an invitation, tried to convince him to join the co-op, and got shut down.
African colors. Subtle.
Tony Gray is pulling 24% now. You need new colors and a new message, Clarence. You need to rally the base.
You want me to start with?
That opening shot was pretty ingenious with the juxtaposition of the campaign poster and the colonial aristocratic.
And his red coat.
Call another game.
It's a waste of time. And right now, time is everything. They're going to spit in your eye and endorse Royce.
They only waited this long out of respect to Tony Gray. Otherwise, they'd give it to Royce months ago.
That's not the point.
You go there uninvited and you're only going to piss them off.
Am I? Or do I piss them off even more by pretending that they don't exist, that I don't need them? I've door-to-doored every neighborhood in this city, saying I'm ready to
be mayor. I guess this is sort of another little education project in that they're trying to figure out how to win.
They endorse
Royce. And that's what we learn in... Or what I've learned from The Wire is that it is, of course, it's not about whether you're a good candidate or a bad candidate. It's all about figuring out a way to win.
At least they get to see a begging-ass white man on his knees. Always a feel-good moment for the folks.
Yeah, the scenes all through this campaign story for the first part of the season just tell that story over and over again in such canny and funny and scary ways about manipulating the press and manipulating the public.
Yes, Charles?
Yeah, they're putting halfway houses in on my block, attics and such.
Not if I have anything.
This politician, Eunetta Perkins, it's the first time I think we've ever seen her. She's always referred to. She's never at the meeting in previous episodes.
That's right. Isn't she set up as the one who Daniel's wife is... running against.
Yes.
Right. And this is a debate. City. I think it's a sparsely attended city council kind of a debate.
Just have to go someplace.
Though not in white neighborhoods.
But they are running against one another, those two.
Ma'am?
And in fact, Watkins right now figures out the inconsistency where Royce has both of them on his ticket. Depending upon what neighborhood he's in.
Right. And so he sees there he himself is not there.
Right.
What's the point? Eventually we all got Annie up.
And here's another card game, but this is one that you have to lose. the mayor has to win. And the fat cats are feeding what they call his walk-around money.
Maybe we got us some more this time. I wouldn't mind if he wasn't so fucking ugly with it.
That two Perry bundle right in the Rogers trip nines.
I folded on a flush.
Full boat 4 hands ago.
It's immoral what it is.
So what's the game, gents?
Don't you teach cards in your classroom or numbers, dice, right? Probability?
Yeah. Yeah, in my journey of learning how to teach at a level that might actually speak to the kids, I experiment.
Well, they do love those games.
I think you lost it, son.
All the way up till the end.
Sign of hers would have shamed Elvis and Tupac both. Her son's deader than both of them. She's just too scared to say so.
That shit wasn't there the first time I talked to her. I just seen it.
Uh-huh. You being a detective and all.
Mm-hmm. Hey, look. She got a friend.
She too young for you, boy.
Young?
They get younger, William. Skinnier, too. We don't.
Younger and skinnier. Where's Jimmy?
That's just the nature of things. Age is age, fat is fat, and nature's nature.
Pitiful.
They pity less. Nature don't care. Nature just is.
Well, they're together and they're talking, but they're not speaking to each other. They're each in their own mindset of what's important at the moment. It's actually has a nice level of comedy, too.
Bet they probe for Mr. Lion.
So then where are my bodies? Here I am over here on the one hand without a body in 6 months, and here you are looking for a suspect who's most likely dead and most likely for dropping one of Marlowe's. And again, if he's dead, where's that body?
You know what the plural of pussy is? Puss eye. Jimmy taught me that.
Where's he putting the bodies, Bob? Huh?
There are a lot of Latin references in The Wire.
Highbrow.
Why is that? Did it come from David's school training or anything?
Maybe, I don't know, but maybe it has to do with words and where they come from and semantic.
Right? Here we also discover that Jimmy is not coming to drink with them.
Yeah.
Jimmy!
It's hard to believe, but he really
Jimmy!
Isn't there. And Bunk's having a little withdrawal from that.
Fucking Huxtables and shit, right?
Every now and then we make right little there. References to other television programs.
Shit, just so they can spring out that shit power every day.
Family ain't comedies. Other police procedurals.
Yeah, we're gonna see.
You hung over?
Here's another one coming up.
Just
in fact.
You look like shit.
You know what you need at a crime scene?
Rubber gloves.
Soft eyes.
Like I'm supposed to cry and shit?
You got soft eyes, you can see the whole thing. You got hard eyes, you stand at the same tree, missing the forest.
Oh, Zen shit.
I think the old Prez...
Soft eyes, grasshopper.
...would have enjoyed the hazing process. Maybe.
Well, when I played the first couple seasons, Prez didn't have much of a sense of humor. He was kind of overwhelmed. In fact, there was this establishing event that happened before the show started where he shot up his car because he was so furious about the being so vulnerable out on the street and stuff. I think he was kind of mad a lot of the time, and you saw him blowing up sometimes. And when he wasn't blowing up, he was getting focused on the case with Lester directing him to do that and stuff.
Hey, don't forget the stippling.
He was being the subject of hazing was probably too raw a subject for him to enjoy.
Tater killed me.
Oh. Is it typed? Because that would hold up a lot better in court. Phone number in other hand.
Standard confidentiality agreement.
And this one?
Oh, that one indemnifies us should you or any of your staff be injured.
That certainly hits home a point where you kind of think of schools as safe environments, not only for adults but for children, and it's not like that in a lot of inner city schools.
Yeah, that little very short scene reminded me of another very short scene, which was after the maybe later in this episode, after the stabbing, there's a EMT or a paramedic in the school office saying that the student wasn't positive, HIV positive. So yeah, there are these concerns of violence and disease in the air that are just in the air.
They're saying you're this year's Band-Aid. Is that how you feel?
I was hoping for more than that.
This year's Splint.
Hey, Miss Sampson.
Yo, he police.
Kids know, somehow.
Seems benign. And I get the sense North Avenue might give us some latitude if
not support.
You think so?
This was a scene that Jim and I worked on for a long time, too. I think it was originally shot to have a lot of point of views where Cuddy is looking at the kids as she's talking. And as it evolved, we changed it to a little bit simpler so that we see these kids going by, but we hear her giving this explanation of Monday to Friday. And then immediately after this, we cut to Colvin touring the school on his own and use some of those POV shots in that sequence instead.
They're feeling that weekend coming. Friday is bad again. This is where I leave you.
Your class. Language arts, huh?
Yes. Anyway, you should see it without me. They behave differently when I'm around.
No doubt.
This is something that was originally part of the first tour.
No, it's not the number of days you've been suspended. It's not the number of years you'll spend in prison if you don't shape up. It's 50% below average. It's 30%.
This method doesn't seem to help people learn more, I think.
Very sad.
It just seems that a good teacher is one that connects with children, and it's really nothing more or less than that. They don't have to be any smarter or any better looking or any faster, but they have to be able to make a connection.
Anybody yeah, Ed here? Talked to me a lot about that, establishing trust and making some kind of a connection. One not a big deal where trust is concerned, and certainly not a big deal where education is concerned, but simply getting through in any way. He'd spend entire days in the classroom, he would tell me, doing some kind of an exercise or a game or something that would just for a second allow them to be in the same space doing the same thing. You know what I mean? And that was a huge achievement.
The amount of money for each kid that shows up one day in September and one day in October.
One day?
After that, they don't lose the government money. So we done with.
Now here's Cuddy getting schooled again in the reality of the system. You, brother.
All right, which one of y'all still needs your September day?
And showing us, the viewer, how incredibly upside down the system is. I never knew that about these credits and headcount issues. It just seems so arcane.
Reinforces one of those overlapping themes between the police department and the city politics and the schools. And the drug businesses, this sort of cheating the system. They show Prez's at the school administrative meeting saying, oh, I've seen this before. They're gaming the stats.
How do we begin? You gonna call a meet? Why don't we begin by you respecting my time and getting to it?
First of all, I heard you may be under the impression I was somehow involved with the late Mr. Bell and his play against you with Brother Musson. I was no way involved. Stringer came at me to set up the parley with you. He used me like he used y'all.
These actors are so fantastic. Robert Chu and Michael Williams. And so, in terms of editing, our strategy is always just to establish the space, get these two actors together, and get into close-up as soon as possible so that you can enjoy their performance together.
I know of a card game on the west side. High rollers, lots of cash money, boxcar size.
You trying to set me up, Joe?
You ever known me to be stupid? I'm trying to make things right here with you.
How much we talking about?
There ain't at least a few hundred K in that room. I wish.
These guys are always trying to get one over on each other in a weird way.
I say again.
It's like a vicious cycle.
What are the strings?
No strings.
What's your cut then?
Quarter of the tape.
But David has created wonderful personalities that are very endearing and feel very unique. And he's also allowed the actors themselves to bring that through. You see it especially, I think, in Robert Chu. And You know, Michael, with his own facial scar, just sort of became Omar and helped forge that character. And you must be Dozerman. It's really great.
Welcome to Major Crimes. I'm Lieutenant Marimo.
Yeah, it's one of my pleasures watching the show. I didn't know a lot of these actors before I did the show, and I still don't know a lot of them because of how many different scenarios there are. For instance, that scene with Omar, and I would never see Omar. I never have any scenes with them. We've now met several times, but going to watch an episode of the show for me is always full of great surprises as an actor watching performances like those.
Rip and run. Can you get with that, Sergeant?
The Western District way, sir.
So here's Kirketti's meeting with the ministers that they were talking about in their political group. And this is who he's going to make a plea to. This is another example of a scene that was just simply shortened for time and economy. There was quite a lot more written.
I don't expect to walk out of this room today with an endorsement from the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance. I don't. But the point is, I think I can be a better mayor for Baltimore than the present one. I voted for Clarence Royce 8 years ago. I voted for him 4 years after that. I felt there was promise in the man. But now I'm disappointed.
It's interesting about this scene and what throws the ministers off a little bit is he's really coming to see them without asking for something. And that's a very unusual scenario.
Wherever I go, people want the same things. They need the same things. But they're just not getting them.
And it seems to be an effective...
I'm not going to ask for your vote now.
Move on his part.
I think just what you were saying about the kids and the teachers, he just needs to be in the same space connecting with them. So we felt like we could shorten the dialogue a little bit.
Thank you.
Councilman, thank you for coming.
It's also a fairly silent environment. Usually we create our environments with just a little bit of life and background chatter or street traffic or some sort of natural environment, and that one was very, very cold to try and heighten that experience of going in almost to the enemy camp and saying, you know, I'm not really asking for anything, just here.
You're the primary on the Braddock case, the dead witness. Norris is back in a rotation.
What?
You caught your first murder. Kudos.
She seems to be the only one that is upset about the fact that the very experienced investigator has been taken off a rather sensitive case.
Don't know. The kids be snitching.
Partially because it's not a smart move, but from a resolution standpoint, but also I think she's worried about perhaps being set up just one more time, this time by the system.
Peace, peace.
Not in a fun and game situation. Like the jokes.
I ain't gonna tell you again. Give me the remote. Y'all learn something today?
And here's another family. I think this is the first time we see Michael's home environment and meet his mother and stepmother and see the depressing environment that he lives in and how he is really a parent to his younger brother.
That's your favorite, right? Start with it.
But like a lot of mothers, she still asks him, what'd you learn in school today? Even though she may not really care or be able to care, beyond being able to care because she's in a drug state.
You good?
I know.
So it turns out the one girl, she went to something stitches to close up. She's looking at a lot of rehab and maybe more surgery. The muscles in her face don't even move right.
How's the class scene?
Like it didn't really happen?
They're still processing. I know it doesn't seem so, but they are.
What about Letitia? What happens to her?
Nothing worse than she's already seen. She'll probably go to a juvenile facility, which is only a little worse than her group home.
She was in a group home?
She grew up in the system, Monday to Friday angry. Last year she was suspended twice and then expelled. Chiquan wasn't positive, though, if you're looking for a silver lining and all.
Excuse me?
She didn't have HIV, in case you were worrying.
I love that scene where you realize what the stakes are all about, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's even worse than you could imagine.
And it goes on, it's great the way the whole season is scripted with Prez's journey in the classroom. And Ed and David both, I think, made a point of letting it take the whole year. You know, it's just learning over and over again how much, as you say, how much is at stake and how much is needed. It's a problem you can either describe quickly or get on top of and solve quickly.
Now, I was going to take Justin and Spot, but Spot ain't been hanging out. And Marcus, I know you got your mother, right? So, Michael, you want to see the fights?
You going? Yeah, I'm in. Yeah.
Right. Come on, get the chair, girl. What's here? The fuck is that?
Souvenir. What?
So this is the result of trying to school Marlo. Security guard gets his big payback right here. By being put behind the
boarded up house.
Yeah.
The playground over at Baker Mall and be at the center of it.
This is one of my favorite scenes I've ever gotten to work on.
The playground just kept on getting bigger.
I find this so moving. First to watch Bubbles as a father figure to Sherrod, who's just brushing his teeth and they're getting ready for bed. In a little shack, and then to see him looking over and seeing what Sherrod's really up to.
Top's calling up the head wall and be the only thing you can hear.
And discovering that Sherrod's illiterate. And it's also interesting because Bubbles does try to mentor Sherrod, and he is able to school him a little bit in the business sense and say, listen, it's either school or business, and they're both valuable, and you need one for the other, and attendance is important. And clearly these are things that Bubbles probably didn't do himself. The other brilliant thing about creating this scenario is that Bubbles does eventually realize that what I'm asking is, do as I say, not as I do. Because Bubbles still is tied to the dope. And not really a perfect example. Even though all his intentions are there. And that's the brilliant aspect of the writing, to be able to reveal the imperfection.
This scene, again, starts with just various faces and goes around the audience, six or seven little 2 or 3 second shots of people. And again, that's really Jim McKay's aesthetic, just trying to choose little bits of reality to begin the sequence.
This also feels like it was a real fight and not completely I don't know the answer to it, but it just has a feel like it was really real as opposed to something that was created for the shoot.
I think it was real. The shots of the ring are real. And then I think that there were reaction shots and the dialogue that were shot separately.
Full house.
Now the episode's kind of bookended with two of Marlo's poker scenes, and here's a chance to win his money back. But
yo, big man, back up. Enter Omar. And this is the most exciting element. This is the big action scene of the episode. Because for the most part, this episode has been about character development and, you know, learning experiences and really setting up the the different environments and different storylines.
Only spenders. I tell you something else. I like that ring, too.
And I think those are very difficult shows to write well and to perform well, because it's always fun to do a scene like this, which is exciting and thrilling. And then, you know, the other element of the ring, which, again, who knows what it really means, but it gets passed around from character to character, as we'll see, without any surface explanation, so that you can take it to mean whatever you wish.
Women in health.
No doubt.
Michael, as Omar in this scene, as he does in all of his great sort of bad guy ripoff scenes, walks such a great line, sort of a larger-than-life, almost, you know, cartoon character, and yet he's always totally believable and always very likable.
That's the real deal. You keep training, I'm telling you, boy.
Has a sort of wry sense of humor about it, but is believable as a real thug.
And we wanted to end that scene on Marlowe because, as he said, this isn't over. And so we wanted you to see his face and remember, this isn't over. Where is this going to go with these two?
And he's still burning about it, believe me.
All right, now, so you live over him.
As Cuddy's dropping off Justin, we tried to put in a couple shots of Michael getting a little more nervous and a little more nervous until now he and Cuddy are left alone in the car.
Thank you. I'm good from here.
And we reveal how, you know, really how skittish Michael is left alone with a grown man. And hopefully that gives you some insight into Michael's backstory.
Again, it's a mentoring situation that's imperfect, that doesn't work, that won't work out for whatever reason. Which, you know, in The Wire, there seem to be very few happy endings.
I love this end music, and I just want to say one more thing, that our brilliant music editor, Blake Lee, wrote this piece, and we have used the same piece every time to end the show, and we'll hand the episode over from the picture department to sound and music, and Blake will sometimes begin the music on the last frame, cutting to black, and in this case he chose to end it as Michael's walking away, which I think is really, really nice.
Thanks for watching. From Karen Thorson.
And I'm Kate Sanford. I'm the editor of this episode.
Well, thanks for watching and for listening. I hope we added some insight. I'm Jim True Frost. I play Prez on the show.